started here. Can you believe it? Episode 4? We are literally going to check in with our audience before we check out for the summer. And I love this for us. I am very excited to dive in with y'all and look at our year in review. As we head into the summer, it's always great to reflect, to pause, to check in with each other, the folks on the screen, and our schools, our communities, our friends. And just a recap of what we've done thus far with Phillips Collaborative. Our episodes have taken you through the state of DEI in this country, Kendrick Lamar's Super Bowl performance, and what that means like for the culture. And additionally, you also got a dose of Phillips Collaborative's origin story, which is very near and dear to all of our hearts. As we look back, we're going to take a peek at the year in review through the lens of education, politics, obviously, pop culture, and all of the identities that we hold together. So with that, you will hear about moments that broke our hearts. You will hear about moments that made us proud, and you will hear about what we're carrying into our summers and beyond. So I'm going to start with the hottest topic, the one that we can't run away from fast enough, and that is national and political landscape in this country. I want to break this up into pieces because we have a lot to cover here. I think one that has affected us in different ways, I'm sure, which I'm happy to hear about or want to hear about, is the attack on our federal workforce. Now, Lawrence, I know, one of your parents was a United States postal worker. And, we have a lot of friends out of work. Our government agencies and institutions that keep our democracy kind of humming are closing. So how are we resisting? How are we going to continue supporting those in our communities, our dads, our moms, our cousins, who are affected by these massive layoffs? How does this affect our work? I'm talking nonprofit funding. I'm talking our libraries, our museums, higher ed. This is a huge question. What are we boycotting? What does our summer look like in terms of how we are responding to and supporting the real people who are affected by the squeeze the Trump administration is putting on our institutions?
Wow.
I know. It's a big one. But it's like puzzle pieces. It all ties together. We can't just say, how are federal layoffs affecting folks? Because it's a domino effect.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that what I want to name is that domino effect, which the implications of that, specifically as it relates to civil rights and the U.S. Department of Education, the idea that the Department of Education is trying to put themselves out of a job means that there are implications for the funding and support of our school systems. And they, as of the most current budget proposal, cuts $12 billion from Head Start, right? Title I funding, which we know is a necessary reparation for historical gatekeeping of wealth and equity in the United States. And this isn't talking. This is babies. This is children.
It's
This is.
800,000. That's how many it affects. It affects 800,000 babies, this cut.
Whose parents work. And so when we talk about the domino effect of the workforce, I think this is one of the things that there's the headlines, and the purpose of the headlines is shock and awe and like freeze. We don't know what to do, right? I think what we're starting to see is there's a lot out there on social media about FAFO. But at the end of the day, that's the reality of it, is that there is no single person in this nation who will not be affected, whether it is directly taking 30 years of your life that you've committed to public service and removing you without cause for the sake of saying we saved money, knowing that the money we saved is only going to create more and wreak more havoc, that then we're going to have to spend more money to clean up later so that we can blame the person who has to clean it up, or it's the people who survive and have survived because our government has always said they care. And now maybe we're just kind of saying what we've always really thought, which is that actually we don't. But I think for me, that's a really important piece of this is those dominoes, those implications. And one of the things I've noticed, and Melina, and you and I have talked about this lately, is that we're about to see unemployment hit an all-time low because I watch LinkedIn. I'm on there all the time and I watch jobs. And 2 months ago, you'd see like a high number of applicants for a job was in the 50s or 60s. I'm looking at jobs now where it's 300 to 500 applications for one job. And it's because people have committed themselves to lives and careers in education, in the arts, in research, in the sciences. And they're being put out of work by the government. And then the decisions the government is making is then that domino of people being put out of work that don't work for the government. And yes, as someone who is deeply embedded in nonprofits, that's nonprofit work, but that's Head Start teachers, right? And so that for me is a terrifying, the economic damage about to be done and the inability to find work. That is something that I've been really sitting with.
The personal is inexorably the political. And the political is inescapably the personal. 96 Atlantic Street is the address of the home that I grew up in for the majority of my life in Jersey City, New Jersey. I think about the block that I grew up on. Who are the heroes and what occupations do they hold? My dad was a mailman, the TV guy, the Jet, the Ebony Essence, bills, checks, disability. People in the 80s and in the 90s got what they got to their doorstep in their mailbox because a federal worker delivered it. My mom was a nurse. She worked formerly in the hospitals, in healthcare. And then she worked in family planning. And to the surprise of many, a lot of the services had nothing to do with abortions. They were really in contraceptives and in counseling and in supports that a lot of young people in underserved communities didn't otherwise get. Down the street were dentists and police officers, all black folks, by the way. But the chiefest of heroes were teachers. Miss Felton is her name. She was the PE teacher at McNair Academic High School in Jersey City. Shouts to Jersey City. McNair Academic, at least at the time, was the top public school in all of New Jersey, and it was in Jersey City, New Jersey. If you were a student on the block, even if you didn't go to McNair Academic, you were afraid of Miss Felton. You could curse up and down the street. You could be profane and act crazy up and down the street. But if Miss Felton came out, you got your act together. Teachers were heroes. Federal employees were heroes. This administration has made us mistrust who we must trust. And you're in a dangerous place in life and in society when you mistrust who you must trust. And now, who must we trust? People who have never worked in education, opining on education, people who aren't qualified to run Veterans Affairs, to be the head of Central Intelligence, because they believe that you can run a country like a business when the country has never been run like a business through a democracy. It's been for the people, by the people. And so this domino effect not only has a deleterious impact on the founding articles of the country, as Jenny alluded to, we're going to be spending so long not only in the disaster relief, but in the reestablishment of trust in our fellow citizen. And at current, it feels a great distance from that day.
You know, I'm wondering because I feel like it's all doom and gloom, right? And I find it so curious that we're in this s stage of this administration where they are so hyper-focused on things like meritocracy. And to your point, Lawrence, so many of the people running these agencies that uphold our democracies are woefully unqualified. The Department of Defense Secretary, Pete, who keeps chatting with his wife and BFF and anyone apparently who will listen to him.
Listen to me. Pete Hegseth is a family man, so committed to his family that he believes that nothing should be hidden from his family. A lot of us want to bring our family to work. He brings his work to his family.
Right. Family means so much. He has children out of wedlock. Yeah, we know. We know. We know. So with all that's going on, and everything's on fire, how are we resisting? That'll be the undercurrent of this, this whole episode. Yes, we want to update people and let folks know, what the actual impact of these things and what that means. But also, like, how are we resisting? Whether that's educators, whether that's federal workers, whether that is your neighbors, like, what do we got going on that we can point people to or empower people to use as tools?
Well, I want to pick up where I kind of left off last episode because I don't want people to get it twisted. This is a bad pronoun game. Who is we?
We? Who's we? There is no we.
Who? What do we do? Me we or you we? Because there ain't no us we.
We? We.
What do you mean, we?
We? No. There's no we.
Two things can exist. we can accurately depict, describe, and decode danger and insist on joy. I can sit in my house and see outside that it's raining. But that rain is outside my house, not inside my house. To be able to accurately depict, describe, decode, and understand the challenges of the day is not synonymous with my fear, with my anxiety, and with my concern, because these are not we issues. These are y'all's issues. You want to remove the Greensboro lunch counter from the museums? You didn't make a dent in Black history. You're trying to conceal white history. You're not, by attacking DEI, hurting the accomplishments and contributions of Africans in America. You're concealing white savagery. So it's not this insistence on delusion. But the conclusion I come to is that this is an issue that impacts y'all far sooner than it impacts us. So I think part of the resistance is the insistence on educating ourselves. I think it's a Mark Twain quote. And Denzel said it, so I remember it from Denzel. Mark Twain's got a little bit of a twisted history.
If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read it, you're misinformed. What is the long-term effect of too much information?
But he ultimately said, if you watch too much news, you're misinformed. If you don't watch enough of the news, you're uninformed. So there's balance. I do just enough to stay informed so I don't stay misinformed. In an era where fear-mongering is at an all-time high, education is liberation. So your joy is commensurate to the amount of education you've availed yourself to.
And Melina and I can attest to the fact that Lawrence does watch the news because we get pictures of his TV as he's watching the news almost on a daily basis.
All throughout the day. We love that you're up with the times, Lawrence. And I think I got a plug here for something Joyanne Reed said last night while I was at Howard University. She said that we, as United States citizens, do not consume enough international news. And I completely agree. I'm going to plug that folks should be tuning in because it's a different frame, it's a different lens through which the world is looking at us. It's very hard to be introspective, I think, when you have elected a dictator twice. Like, obviously, we didn't learn enough the first time. So, what makes us think that we are thoughtful enough to dissect like how we got here and what's going on accurately? So, just a plug for international news, folks. Open your eyes and your ears to that. I will say that I think we have a little bit of a comatose public. And I think part of that comatose comes from social media. It's great to get your news, where you can, and we are all victims of the algorithm. The algorithms, it one tilts conservative, tilts right because of who owns the algorithm and the social media platform. Who built those algorithms? A whole bunch of white men in a basement somewhere in Silicon Valley. And these technocrats don't, they want less regulation. So of course they're going to lean conservative. They want those tax cuts. Of course they're going to lean conservative. So I think part of the resistance should be disengaging with something that literally is putting us in a comatose. It's literally, when taken in too large of a dose, is affecting how we feel empathy for one another. And these rabbit holes we go down on social media are just confirmation bias after confirmation bias after confirmation bias, and don't expose us to anything different. That would be my two cents in terms of resistance over the summer.
We had this whole conversation, Melina and I went through the list of international news on our phone to say, like, what are we looking at? What are we paying attention to? Mm-hmm. And I want to add a little to what Melina said, which is go to places you might not normally go. Number one, like, put NPR on when you're in the car. Like, that's a great, just easy start. I use the iHeartRadio app. It's free. And there's a Black news network. And so I will often listen to that on my way to work in the morning. And so I do think that hearing news through many voices is a part of what Lawrence was talking about with the educating yourself, right? Because we have to undo some of our education. And it's very hard to do that until you're confronted with something that will challenge it. And so part of our job right now in resistance is to find those things that we encounter that confronts something that is our lived or learned experience in a way that we feel challenged. And one of the questions I've had from a number of people who have become very politically active for the first time in their lives, and, you know, I work with young people, so some of these are 17, 18, 24-year-olds, and I work with some folks who, this is the first time they've done it, and they're in their 60s. So I'm going to say, number one, the 50-50 movement, go to the rallies, because if you don't know where to start, and you'll see this in some articles we'll be releasing soon, and one of the things I write about is resistance in community and in groups is really powerful right now.
Ginny, can we back up? Can you explain the 50-50 movement for our listeners?
Yeah, so it started as 50 protests in 50 states on one day. And what I love about it is that it is truly grassroots. And so it's organized by people within the communities that are holding these rallies. And the 50-50 movement is simply a place to centralize and share information for it. And they are continuing. It started as one day, and it's now turned into once a month, sometimes twice a month. And it's a place to go, number one, to learn. If you know things are going wrong and you don't know why or how, that's where people are gathering that can answer your questions. That's where I've had people ask me, what do I do about what's happening with people being stolen off the streets, people being stolen from courthouses, people being stolen from schools? Like, what do I do? Those are places you can go and ask those questions. And the other piece of this that I've seen happen at so many of these is small community organizations that have been doing the work we need to have done for a very long time. They're present here. And when they are at these places, they're sharing their information. They're telling you how to get involved. And so your resistance might just start with figuring out the places you can go to resist. And one of the things I think is really important is to be in groups. And it's a lot harder for our government, because we do live in a time of surveillance, to target a group of people over a single person. So find your community, find the work you can do locally. And I'm specifically talking to white folks, right? Because in a group, we're not going to be targeted. That's very different for people of color. And so I think get out there, get the information that's going to challenge you, and then go to the places where people are gathering. This is also happening at churches. There are a lot of churches right now that are ground zero for community organizing. So that's
We
what,
love our churches because
yes.
they've been in it for, I mean, yes, they're problematic. And like they've been in it for the long haul. Like they've been here. They're like, oh, we've seen this before. I will also say newsletters, like in terms of like getting your news from different places. I want to highlight the things that are happening to transgender and gender non-conforming and non-binary folks right now. The LGBTQ Bar Association has a monthly newsletter. If you are looking for legal tips that affect you or your community in terms of travel right now, how to exist in a public space or in some place like Florida or Texas, check out their newsletter. Additionally, Heather Cox Richardson is a professor at BC, and
Yes.
she has a newsletter. I don't know how she does it. Homegirl puts one out like every day. I'm like, whoa. Kudos to her, but she has a newsletter and it's free. Like, and you know you're gonna get accurate information, not mis and disinformation or what I like to call now just flat out lies, because that's what they are. Those are my other plugs that I had.
One of the things I would say, and I think the resource sharing and Jenny, I think your points toward the 50-50 movement, I think are helpful. One of the things I think just from a psychological, social, emotional perspective is to just prepare for the cognitive dissonance that comes from doing your own independent research, your own critical thinking. I'll give you an example. The more that I comb through civil rights as an era, the more I comb through the life, the legacy, the work of Dr. King, the more I realize that his philosophy related to the advancement of colored people was unpopular amongst Black people. That had nothing to do with desiring a proximity to whiteness. It was actually the opposite. There were throughout the South folks who had the money and already owned Black bus companies. And they were saying to Dr. King, we'll provide the buses. Let's just let Black folks take care of Black folks. They felt that the civil rights movement was a proxy for integration that would be dangerous for the sustainability and the thriving of Black people.
Were they wrong?
What did Dr. King say on the night before he died? In great counsel with Harry Belafonte. Harry Belafonte saw that his close confidant, close friend, was deeply concerned and deeply troubled, and he asked him about it. And King said, you know, I think we'll get the vote. I think we're going to get some rights. But he said, what's weighing on him is that I fear that we've integrated into a burning house. He died lamenting the thing he hung his legacy on. If one were committed to knowing the heroes, to knowing the villains, to knowing what was right, to knowing who was right, part of the analysis paralysis or the comatose that Melina was describing earlier is a lion's share of the population who's gotten to the age that they've gotten to believing that they were right, their parents were right, their grandparents were right. Their clergy were right. The people that they trusted were right. So to unlearn everything that I have learned is a confrontation of the cataclysmic kind. And so going into the summer or going into tomorrow, prepare to do as much unlearning as you will learning.
Yeah, and I want to tag on to that, Lawrence, by saying, as a white person who's had those cataclysmic moments, if you haven't felt at jeopardy or you haven't risked something since this administration took power, I just want to name that. Because that, you can't get past that. And back to your question, Melina, I have no say in that question.
Right. But
But I think.
I think you're right, Ginny and Lawrence. I don't think that this is a summer 2020 moment in that we can book club ourselves out of this. Like I yes, of course, like who am I? I'm the book girl. I am the educator, right? But like, yes, read the things. Yes, do the unlearning. Yes, do the learning. And a book club is not going to save democracy. Like, I think there's, and this speaks to my choice of words when I said comatose, there's a certain urgency that people are not feeling. Most of my real life friends in DC, love it or not, are lawyers and economists. And they are, when we have our mom wine hours or two, the last one was really alarming because all of the lawyers and economists were like, why isn't everyone here protesting? Like every single person in the country. They said we should be alarmed. We are several steps past constitutional crisis. And we are in the throes of an oligarchy, right? We are in the throes of techno-feudalism. As I say that, I'm wondering how we don't book talk this. Like, I don't want our audience to be like, you know what? I'm gonna read that book and everything's gonna be fine.
Here's me taking a risk,
Uh-oh.
and Malene and I are friends. I will grab a black superhero by the cape. Do you know, in ocean rescue or saving a drowning person, do you know what the worst kind of victim is? Someone who flails, someone who doesn't trust the person who's saving them. Not only could they drown, they could drown you trying to save them. I don't trust the victims just yet because we have been here summer 2020, and many of us long before that. We will organize, we will mobilize, we will teach. We will train. We will put structures in place. We will institutionalize DEI. We will find the value proposition. We will do the thing. And all it took is an administration to. And there's dust in our capes. I am not saying that we should be late, and I'm not saying that we should be lazy. I'm not saying that we should be stagnant, but I've got a very clear memory emblazoned in my spirit about what happened the last time we jumped into the pool. And so I think, as an African in America, it is a very important thing to resist helping people who have refused help in the past. And yeah, it could get worse. But maybe then people would know that they're actually drowning.
I appreciate so much about what you just said, Lawrence, because, and to your point, not helping people who haven't wanted help before where have you been? Right? Like, where have you been? And I recently learned a new phrase, which y'all know I get excited when I learn things, and it's kleptocracy. And this wasn't something I knew before. And I think it's something that is speaking to the moment we're in, right? And I heard that word klept, and I was like, klepto, right? Like, this has got to be about theft. And it is, right? It's when you have people in positions of power who are creating policies and acting in a way that they financially benefit by taking away from the public good. And it's not going to get better in a month. We're 3 months into 48 months. And I'm sorry, Melina, because I know that one hits.
But, it does. It feels like 7 years.
Well, and if you think about it, Vladimir Putin has spent decades trying to do what Trump did in 3 days. Months.
I know. But I think these people that we're talking about, like when you ask the question, Jenny, where have they been? You know what they've been doing? They've been voting out democracy. Mm-hmm. Just like Brazil did. You know, just like Hungary did. Just like Russia did. Right? And now Russia still has elections, right? But 99.99% of the population somehow, some way, always vote for Vladimir Putin. And I think the United States is one of those countries now that we can add to the list that the folks have been busy voting out democracy. That's what they've been doing. I want to name a relationship that I learned about last night is that most of the technocrats are white South Americans. I know, we know, we like Zuck is in the news. Because Facebook and IG are, you know, a dumpster fire. And of course, we know Elon bought Twitter. But I actually didn't know that if you look at a list of all the technocrats in the world, most of them are white South Africans who would love nothing more than to create another apartheid state that they had to flee. They can with their billions and billions and trillions of dollars. And I think we are, unfortunately, ground zero. We're ripe for the pickings because what do they want? Tax cuts and deregulation. So that was a little more time than I wanted to spend on that, but I'm really happy that we were able to dig a little deeper into, I think, something that's affecting a great majority of the population. I want to talk about some wins, though. What wins are worth celebrating right now in the midst of all of this, whether that be a movement, whether that be maybe a city or a state that is standing up to this flurry of executive orders that we see every week? What are we celebrating?
You know, I mean, I never whole cloth endorse anything or anyone really, but I am proud of Governor Wes Moore staying pretty firm, you know, really finding space within the margins and insisting on the support of people, the commitment to education, the commitment to the workforce. I saw something he said on social media recently saying, you know, that he will work with anyone, but he will bow down to no one. And I thought that that kind of ethos and heart from a governor was particularly admirable. Cory Booker talking about standing and delivering. I didn't know that filibustering could become an Olympic sport, but I think my Jersey boy did a long way in doing that. Props to, and I'm losing her name at the moment, but the governor of Maine, who ultimately stood by her entire state, but certainly stood up for trans children. Not only the trans community, but preying on a child as the headline for the subterfuge to seize very vital funds to public education. Just say that you hate public schools. Just say that you're trying to strip away public education, but it is a certain kind of cowardice to use a child as the lead singer for a song you want to play. And so I think Wes Moore, I think Cory Booker's filibustering, and the governor in Maine have really been some really good examples of courage in that moment. Not emblematic of standing in the front line, but standing on business. And I respect that.
Why am I not surprised that Lawrence just talked about my first two things, which Cory Booker, I'm gonna shout that out as well because so many people logged in. And I think that for people in a comatose state to hop on and there was this beautiful moment in our house when he was speaking, and my wife and I had come home, and she's not necessarily someone who's always going to sit down and watch something political. Like, that's not how she gets involved. And she sat down and didn't move for a couple of hours. And like the cheering in our house and the tears and the joy in that culminating moment. But I looked over and she had her iPad and she had her phone and she had the TV and they were all on different platforms. Because she was like, I want so many views on this. But the reality was, I mean, I was viewing it with 1 million people. And so for people to be that invested in a moment in our history, I think it's a rarity these days. And I think that was part of what made it really special. Also, Governor Mills in Maine, that was not what I expected. And it was a really cool moment. I also want to say Bernie Sanders and AOC touring the country, they might as well be Beyonce, but it's free. Like they're stadium size crowds gathering to hear them. And if they come up this way, I'm going because I want to hear. Like, what are the people in power? Who are the resistors? What are they saying? And so that's the one that I would add is Bernie Sanders and AOC out there just, well, and of course we can't let an episode go by without saying Jasmine Crockett's name.
I love her. She's a little firecracker.
Shouts to Jazzy
Right.
Crockett, Delta Sigma Theta. I dig it. Jenny,
Texas.
when you were talking, hey, Hans, there you go. When you were talking about AOC, it was giving me vibes of Naughty by Nature, and it's like, you down with AOC? Yeah, you know me, yo. She might have some. Put it on the shirt.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think I am celebrating the fact that the New York City public schools kind of gave a middle finger to the Trump administration when it came to upholding their DEI policies within their schools. I mean, anyone who's been to New York City knows that New York City's superpower is its diversity. You walk down the streets and you hear, 30, 40 languages in a few blocks. So I'm really proud of them. I want to shout out also my senator, Senator Van Hollen, who went to El Salvador and pretty much demanded to see Abrego Garcia and didn't leave until he was able to sit down and put his eyes on him. Before that, so many of, I mean, probably us in a group chat, like a lot of my friends were like, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't know. But like when I finally saw him, I was like, oh, thank God he's alive. I can't believe I'm saying this in terms of like our, federal government disappearing, United States citizens, and yet here we are. Additionally, Representative Presley from Massachusetts went to the detention center in Louisiana, and she wanted to lay her eyes on Mahmoud Khalil. I'm going to butcher her name, and I do not want to. But the student who was abducted from the streets of Boston, she's a Tufts University PhD student, and all that poor baby did was co-author an op-ed. So shout out to our politicians who are finally, maybe, hopefully, growing a spine and doing something more than saying, this is outrageous. We shouldn't be doing this.
Thoughts and prayers.
Right. Thoughts and prayers. This is bad. Right? Like,
well,
I'm waiting for Jeffries. I'm waiting for Jeffries to stop his mess.
Well, listen, here's something radical in real time. The president wants to work to deport homegrowns. From what I hear, there was a mass shooting at Florida State last week. If you want to deport violent Americans, there's a very violent American that maybe we can prisoner swap. But I'm sure it'll be a mental health case.
Oh, I'm sure. So Lawrence, quick question. What demographic in the United States are the serial killers most of the time?
Oh, white male.
Oh, you don't say.
I was 2 years old. Now here's the thing. We are very inclined because I don't care. People will be committed to misunderstanding. We can be very specific when we want by gender and by race when we talk about issues. I'm an 80s baby. When we talked about the HIV AIDS epidemic, we had no problem saying it was an LGBTQ issue. We had no problem saying that they were mostly black and brown people. When we talked about crack, we had no problem saying that they were in inner cities, hoods, and ghettos. When we talked about the war on drugs, and they talked about the welfare queens, the president then of the United States had no issue saying that it was black women. We have no issue being very specific about race and crime when the demographic is not white. Disproportionately, mass shootings and school shootings is a white boy's game. If we can be specific, we should be specific.
We should. Thank you for that clarity. I appreciate you.
Yes. Yes. Always choose the bear. I want to name one more that I think it's worth celebrating. And that's the Jewish students at Columbia who chained themselves to the fence this week in protest of Gaza. And that, I think, is a really complicated and complex conversation that lots of folks aren't having. But to stand up within your own community and to have people willing to do that and put their bodies on the line, that's a win worth celebrating.
I agree. Thank you for that. And I also want to name that the Yale students started another encampment ahead of a visit from a far-right Israeli official that's coming. They were like, absolutely not. So shout out to them putting their educations, their careers, their futures, their degrees, all that they've worked for on the line, and quite possibly their bodies. I'm celebrating them and their bravery. I want to pivot real quick and talk about a little bit about what has moved us culturally this year. We've had a lot happen culturally this year. From Beyonce, homegirl finally won album of the year. You know, we had the 50th anniversary of hip hop. We had Bad Bunny release another album, Debí Tirar Más Fotos. There's also been a lot of things happening within the LGBTQIA+ community, WNBA. I mean, we could go on and on and on. What has moved y'all this year in that space?
Yeah, I'll take an opportunity. And it's recency bias because when we finish today, I'm going to go see Sinners by Ryan Coogler. So much in the iconography of Chadwick Boseman and in the prodigy of Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, just this generation, which I don't think gets enough credit, the cinematic brilliance, the storytelling, the writing. If anybody wants a modern day cinematic role model, check out Ryan Coogler. I just think that his run in such a short period of time, from Fruitvale Station to the Black Panther franchise, I mean, even now with Sinners, and there's a ton more. Here's what he said that I've just thought was so touching. He was looking at the time because he played college football, and then he pivoted and pursued producing and film development. He basically got out of film school and went on to do Fruitvale Station in a time that helped him catch the final years of Chadwick Boseman's life. Essentially, if he hadn't gone out and pursued his dream in blind faith and belief in Prodigy, we would have all missed out on the gift of Chadwick Boseman. And so I think in a moment where we can talk about wins with established figures who maybe elevate into celebrity, here goes someone right now in front of our eyes who's telling not just Black stories. He's telling American stories. He's not just talking about fiction when you talk about Marvel or the Black Panther. He's talking about the continent of Africa. Real-time genius in our eyes. I'd point to Ryan Coogler.
We all have the assignment to see Sinners this weekend. I'm seeing it tomorrow. Look for that in a forthcoming episode.
For sure. We are going to debrief.
I want to point back to something that I had previously mentioned on the podcast, which is everything related to music and culture around the Super Bowl. Whether it was God Bless America, whether it was the national anthem. We've talked about all that Kendrick Lamar did. And I think to tie to what Lawrence just said, it felt like American life in honesty. And I think the same way about Beyonce. And country has always had roots in Black and African culture. And the reclamation of that has been so beautiful. The number of people and places supporting the LGBTQ community. So shout out to an organization, completely nonprofit, completely volunteer organized, the Collaborative that just opened here in Manchester, New Hampshire. In the face of everything going on, every single person that works there is a volunteer. And they opened a space for the LGBTQ and trans community in the central of a central area of one of our major cities. And it was like, yeah, everything else is going on. And we don't care. We're going to take care of each other. And we're going to keep doing what we do. And so just from a local culture moment, that was really important.
Thank you for that. I'm gonna talk about Bad Bunny's album and his decision to not tour, but instead have a residency in Puerto Rico. This is kind of artistically and musically, he has returned to his like reggaeton roots. A lot of samples and melodies and things like that that are very like old school reggaeton. But also he infused the album with something called Plena, which is a African rooted type of music that we have on the island of Puerto Rico. And it's hundreds of years old. It's not something that's usually elevated to the level of a megastar like Bad Bunny. But he did it on purpose because it's an infusion of African drums, indigenous folks, and obviously the language of our colonizers. And he was just so intentional about bringing the world to Puerto Rico, infusing the island with dollars from tourists. And he has a track on his album that translates into, "I don't want what happened to Hawaii to happen to us." Bad Bunny, Benito, does not want Puerto Rico to become a state. He wants it to maintain its independence. He was recently on Tiny Desk, and he talked about colonialism. He's not perfect, but to elevate as someone who is not, you know, a practitioner like we are, to decide and commit to elevating the island, elevating the issues that we have around being displaced, colonialism, like what is actually happening on the island, is, you know, deserves all of the celebration, all of the flowers, because it's hard to do. It excites me to think that our culture is being elevated in this way, in a respectful way, in a correct way. I know that he actually tapped some professors. They gave him homework. They gave him books to read to learn about the history of Puerto Rico. And, you know, he says, "I'd never learned any of this in school." I think it's very similar to what we have going on here, because we have all learned a history of a country that has never existed. Never. And that's why I think we're full circle here. We're back to removing the Greensboro counter and stools at the African American Museum here in DC. Because they're trying to erase all of the reminders of what really happened here. Their problem is not our problem, is that 13% of the American population is Black. We are living artifacts. Our DNA is a testament to our survival, our resilience, our joy, and how fly we are. That is kind of what has moved me in review this year.
Well, Melina, I just wanted to add to what you said, because I think there's an important footnote there, and I'll stick with the Bad Bunny piece. Here's what people need to understand about liberation. The more that I learn about my ancestry, my history, even the pain, it only causes me to love more, because I love myself more. I understand myself more. I'm pouring in the gaps in my soul that I know were missing, but I didn't know what it was. Liberation only produces love. When you see these gatherings and there's so much hate, suppression has to be afoot. What's perpetuated to the public is that if you are given history, if you are allowed to teach history, you're going to hate your colonizers. You're going to hate people whose ancestry and ancestors oppressed yours, when that's actually not the reality. Depriving people of history is the fuel for hate. Liberation leads to love. And so what you would find in Bad Bunny's excavation and exploration is a real joy vis-a-vis liberation. So if history is being deprived from you, you have to ask yourself what the end game is. And it's to hold on to hatred.
I love that, Lawrence, because I truly do feel and believe firmly that liberation results in nothing but love. Hang on with me here. Follow me here. You and I have very different skin tones. I did a little digging because I was like, huh, I thought I knew why I was light skinned, right? I was like, my mom's Puerto Rican. I want to empower our viewers, our audience members, to maybe embark on this summer. But I did a little digging in terms of my ancestry, because I wanted to figure out and learn more about where I come from, like who my folks are, who my ancestors are. My skin tone is evidence of a crime. I do not have any white ancestors. Everyone is black on my dad's side. I can go back to when they were enslaved in Texas and in Alabama. I have no white ancestors on my mother's side of the family. They're all poor, uneducated day laborers in Puerto Rico. Sugarcane, to be exact. My hair texture, my skin tone, all of which I love, are evidence of a crime. Because no one married anyone white. No one had a family with anyone white. This unearthing of that fact filled me with so much love for all those people on, you know, on those census records that had fourth and fifth grade educations, that emancipated themselves. It literally, learning about them, seeing their names on those pieces of paper, those rolls, filled me like bursting. There is so much power and love and liberation with learning about your history, where you come from, who you are. And so I want to empower those who listen to us to maybe take a gander, maybe take a peek and see what you learn. You may be surprised.
Melina, I love that. What a great excavation.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to note here, being pro me is not anti you.
Never.
So it's interesting in this political moment how, in order to be pro us, we have to be anti you. Interesting. Here's the thing, though, I do think is important. I think there is a monetizing of the moron that I think is really important for folks to unpack. The monetizing of the moron. If I learn about my history, if I learn about your history, if I learn about colonialism, if I learn about the first Holocaust, the actual word means to be burned as a sacrifice. That's what Holocaust, K-A-U-S-T, Holocaust means to be sacrificed by fire. That the first Holocaust was of enslaved Africans in America, and where Hitler got his inspiration was from slavery in America. If I learned all of that, I could still be pro me. I wouldn't be anti you, but I wouldn't let you monetize me because I'm not a moron. I wouldn't perform at your inauguration. I wouldn't wear your hat. I wouldn't want proximity with you. You couldn't make money off of me. Clearly, Black thought is not a monolith. Liberated thought isn't a monolith, but I am noticing how easy it is now, how easy it always has been to monetize a moron. Oh, and if you find yourself by listening offended, then you might be the moron.
Yes, because even though what we say may be hard to hear, that does not mean we are wrong. All right, y'all. Thank you so much for this episode. It was way more than I expected. And hopefully you all feel like we have covered this year in review to justice. So thanks for tuning in.